and the Air Force. Mm. And again, this may be reaching a little bit, but would you have any Navy or Air Force people there as well in with you, or again, it was strictly Army, Army. Giving the normal Army reaction to messages coming in, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. While I was there, I used to go out once in a while in the evenings to see what the air looked like. I saw the first buzz bombs come over. I was there the day they started.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody on the ground had the slightest idea what they were.
No
ordinary people.
They
came over, they could see the little light, so we knew they weren't Germans. And then you could see them being shot down, so we knew they weren't ours.
Yeah.
So what were they?
Anyhow,
that was that's a vivid memory.
Yes, I'll bet. I'll bet. And this, you were there for a couple of months, and then you say you go back to the
Second Division.
Mm-hmm. Let me think now. The Second Division went over in July, 1944. As I remember.
I didn't go back to the Second Division. I went over. I went over with Army Headquarters. I went over with the Chief Engineer.
Oh, I see.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
But that was Jock McLean from Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One other interesting thing, which again you may know all about, is the deception plan in Dover Harbor with the battleships. The harbor was crammed full of naval craft, and I could go out on my canteen on the cliffs and look down and see all these ships.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you had a day when there was a breeze. And then you could see them all wiggling. They were all phony.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was an incredible piece of camouflage that they did.
Good Lord.
And much of that stuff, much of that, what do they call it, deception equipment, was developed at a film studio in Shepparton, in Sound City.
Is that right? Yeah. I knew that they had these deception schemes and fake camps and fake traffic and fake signs and the whole damn lot.
But the ships were something really to see.
I'll bet. Yeah. And I bet you didn't have a camera with you.
Well, I discouraged that sort of thing.
Yeah. So then you go with the chief engineer of the Canadian Army,
right.
Probably be Brigadier someone or other, I would think, or maybe...
Yeah, McLean.
Yeah. And what were you doing with him?
I was SO2 operations, staff officer, grade 2 operations.
Yeah. And let's see, you get to Normandy now. Again, just going by memory myself, the Canadian Army headquarters became operational, I think, either the end of July or early August, something like that.
Yes, we hadn't broken out yet when we went over, or when I went over.
No, the breakout doesn't come until the 21st, 22nd of August, actually. Yeah.
We were still trying to take Carpiquet Airport.
Ah, yeah.
And we had Kong, and I went into Kong a couple of times. And then we started to move, and...
Did you have any major job in Normandy itself that you had to consider?
No, not... do you mean the engineers themselves?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the great thing was the bridges, because they destroyed 5,000 bridges in France during the war. Most of it was bridging, and then the big operation was at... with Arnhem.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever bump into Creerer himself?
Oh, yes.
How did you find him?
Well, I didn't bump into him really that
much.
Closely.
Yeah.
But I was... I think he was pretty able.
Mm-hmm.
I think he... was doing a job, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, really, I suppose from an army point of view, I'm just thinking of the Normandy operation. There was nothing major there that I can remember that would affect the engineers, aside from bridging the Orne and the canals, but that would be on a divisional rather than an army level or anything of that nature. Then you get the breakout.
And the airports.
The airports. Yeah, and that would be your responsibility.
That was the responsibility of Brigadier John Paul Carrier. He was in charge of airports.
Yeah. Did you have anything to do with that yourself?
Not except that I saw him every day.
Yeah. You know?
It's much like a dream.
I know what you mean.
It didn't seem as if we were doing very much at Army headquarters, but the people in the front were doing.
They most well. Certainly were. Yeah. Well, then when you get the breakout, which goes roughly from the 22nd of August,
mm-hmm.
and that great. Tremendous thrust
mm-hmm.
forward.
Mm-hmm.
From an engineering point of view, I can see some of your problems are going to be crossing some of the major rivers, but I also wonder, did you have anything to do as an engineer with helping to bust into the fortified towns and cities that constituted the Atlantic Wall on the way up and which we had to take?
I'm sure there was a lot done there, but again on the divisional level, on the
I see.
Right down on the working level.
Yeah. Well, again, from your point of view, as a staff officer, one of your jobs presumably is to look ahead 2, 3, 4 weeks, or maybe months, without a doubt. What could you see coming up once a breakout started, and what did you do about it? Or is that too big a question?
Big question. Yeah. It's difficult to answer. I don't know how much we knew about what was going to happen or how fast it was going to happen.
Mm.
The feeling I have is that we were going very much day to day. I know that's. That's not true, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And.
But thinking in terms of those innumerable canals and rivers up in Holland and Belgium, you didn't have any special job that required you to do some special work or preparations?
No. Right. We wrote engineering operation orders for various things. To the divisions, I used to ride around with the chief engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Which was quite a scary job. Once Jeff Walsh came in there as chief engineer after a while.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he used to ride all over the place.
In a Jeep, sort of thing?
Yeah. Of course, there was you couldn't tell where mines had been cleared.
And, I know. You know. You can get nervous in the service, as the saying goes.
Yeah.
Did you come across any period that you can remember which was particularly difficult for the engineers? What would you say was the most difficult job that the engineers had?
Getting the people back from Arnhem, I guess.
And how did they come into that?
Well, the Canadian engineers built the bridges and or ran the boats to bring the survivors off from Arnhem.
Did they?
Mike Tucker, who was a commander of one of the field companies, was recommended for the VC on that job, and he didn't get it. I guess Canada had its quota.
Yeah.
Got a DSO for it. Very, very magnificent job he did.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That was,
Would you have had anything to do with that yourself, or
no? No, I maybe should have done, but I was supposed to go to a field company,
mm-hmm.
because we all did, you know.
Sort of rotate.
Yeah. But I got injured and had to go back.
What happened? How did you get injured? Was it?
Well, I got into a problem in a vehicle.
Oh,
that was in the back. I got thrown out. My leg got badly bashed up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I'd had a history of blood problems with they decided they would that I wasn't going to be around for quite a while, so
mm-hmm.
they'd send me back. I
mm-hmm.
went back to Maidenhead.
When was that?
Oh, it was after we were well into Holland.
That would be October, November 44.
Yes, I would think so. It was it was getting to winter.
Can you think incidentally of anything that we did, that the Canadians did as engineers, which were later, shall we say, adopted by the British or Americans or anybody else? I mean, I'm trying to think in terms of some sort of unique Canadian contribution to the military engineering.
I probably could, but I don't know whether I'm the right person to ask.
Mm.
I can't... I can't offhand think of anything, but there must have been many things that we...
I think now, you know, one of the outstanding contributions, and I don't know if this was invented during the war or before the war, and that of course is the Bailey Bridge. Well, now who was Bailey? It was
an English British.
Yeah.
Englishman. Yeah.
Another goodie for us, you know, from the infantry point of view, was a flail tank.
Yes.
Now, I wonder whose idea that was. Did we do anything that you can think of?
No, I can't think of anything offhand, except what we did very well.
Yeah. We were good, I understand, at building airports and building roads
mm-hmm.
using modern equipment, and I gather we did it at a much faster rate than the British.
Yes. Yes, well, the 2nd Division in particular, the CRE of the 2nd Division was John Peter McKenzie
mm-hmm.
From Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
And he had people like Cy North. You remember the man who blew up the Ripple Rock?
Oh, yeah.
He was a company commander, and Jock McLean, of course, who was later chief engineer.
Mm-hmm.
They had a pretty substantial team for doing this kind of high Worcester, from Swan, Worcester.
Yeah.
So I think we did our share on that, especially in England before we went over.
Well, what happened to you after you got back to England?
Well, I got sent back to Canada, and again out to Pacific Command, General Worthington was the commander.
Well, that'd be after Perks was left, that'd be 45.
Yeah, Worthington, and Worthington at that time, as everybody knows, was an outlaw in the United States. He was outlawed after the Spanish-American War
mm-hmm.
for assisting Pancho Villa.
Mm-hmm.
But he was admitted back in while I was in Pacific Command. He went down to San Francisco and I gave him a 21-gun salute. And made him persona grata again.
Yeah.
From there, I went to Washington for 3 years as liaison officer with the U.S. Corps of Engineers.
But you're still in the Army then?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. For heaven's sakes, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What made you remain in the Army?
Well, I came back to Canada to go to Korea, but then...
Oh, to Japan, you mean? The war with Japan was still on.
No, we were going to Korea. There was a force, Canadian force went to Korea, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that, you're up and out about 1950.
Am I 50? Oh, well, I must have been mistaken.
But there, we were going to send a division over to the Pacific. It was called the, I think it was called the Canadian Pacific Force.
It organized itself in Washington State at Fort...
It could be. Yeah.
Fort something rather, just south of here. Well, yeah. that's what I came back to do.
I see.
we didn't do that. Or I didn't do that. And I went... After I was here with Worthington, I went to Washington for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back up to Queen's University as the resident staff officer.
Oh, yeah.
For, that was in beginning of 50.
Mm-hmm.
52, or end of 51, I guess. They set up a joint U.S.-Canadian engineering exercise in the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to be the Canadian commander on that.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise was known as Eager Beaver.
Yeah.
It consisted of an American construction battalion from Oklahoma and a Canadian field squadron from... Even forgotten the number of the field squadron.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting thing. We built the airfield at Kewaunee. It was built to see if an airfield could be built on the permafrost with enough insulation so that it didn't, so that it was stable.
Yeah.
And it's still stable and it's still being used.
Is that right?
And the Americans moved up a tremendous amount of mechanical equipment to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
Still being used.
Is that right?
And the Americans moved up a tremendous amount of mechanical equipment to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
So we were there all winter, which was... we found out that men really didn't produce very much below 50 below zero.
Oh, bad. Oh, God, yeah.
That was the point.
Yeah.
And then after that, I went back to Ottawa as deputy director of quartering, looking after camps, and especially the ones we built in Germany for the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, by this time, what rank would you be?
This time I was a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I retired as.
Yeah. Didn't, as a commander of the field squadron building the airport, what would the rank be there? Was that a major, or...?
I was a major. I wasn't commander of the field squadron. I was the commander of the exercise.
The
Canadian commander.
The
field squadron was commanded by somebody else.
I see.
So it was a sort of an odd job, a sort of an overall thing.
Yeah.
But I very soon recognized the difference, some of the differences between the American forces and ours. And one story that might interest you.
Mm.
I came in one night to the orderly room where the flag... We take our flag down at sunset. The Americans take it down at a fixed time every day. So we compromised and lowered both the flags at a fixed time.
Yeah.
The orderly corporal was there. He was an American. And he was folding the flags to put them away. This was in the days before. Well, it doesn't matter to the story. He'd folded the American one, but it was pretty late. And I said, what's the trouble, Corporal? This should have been done an hour ago. He said, well, sir, he said, I cannot fold this Canadian flag. The American flag has to be folded so no red shows.
For heaven's sake.
And he was trying to fold the Canadian flag so no red showed.
Yeah.
He wasn't very bright there.
Oh, my word.
But he was trying. I gave him A for effort.
Yeah.
Another thing is... with the National Guard set up in the States,
mm-hmm.
you can be in the regular army and also in the National Guard. You can belong to both. And we had one fellow up there who was a captain in this National Guard construction battalion, but he was a sergeant in the regular army.
Oh, for heaven's
sake. And it was quite clear to which rank he really belonged.
Yeah.
This made things, these little things made difficulties, you know.
Yeah, how did the Canadians Americans get along, generally speaking?
Very well.
Yeah.
Very well. We had there was a lot of Indians in the American battalion from Oklahoma.
Oh, is that right?
Their master sergeant was one of the finest fellows I ever met, Master Sergeant Bearskin.
Yeah.
He was well over 6 feet. But, again, in the American Army, an NCO cannot arrest a man. He has to go and find an officer to do it. And this caused all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
So I asked them if they could send me a provost sergeant from the Canadian Army, and that we agreed then that the provost sergeant could handle anything that was necessary.
You mean in sort of either force?
Yes.
Yeah.
But, this is a little bit aside from what you want to hear.
Yeah,
right?
No, it's interesting, though. You know, there's not too terribly many exercises that you get the two forces together.
No.
It's especially, you know, we tended in our history to work with the British more than the Americans.
Yes.
And I know that there were several exercises in the North, and one, I think there was a big one called Musk Ox, and another one called Polar Bear.
That's
and
right.
So on like that. And I don't know, those, it's an area I've never been in the North, I've flown over it, I have no desire to go up there. You know, one hears about mosquitoes and black flies and God knows what else, and it's perishing bloody cold and a whole bit.
It's cold, yes. But one of the thing people don't realize about the Yukon is that the center of the Yukon is practically a desert. And the total precipitation is only about 3/4 of an inch a year. So you get very little snow. You get maybe 6 or 8 inches of snow, but it stays all winter. One thing that disturbed me at the time was the terrible fear of my American counterpart, Colonel Brown, fear of the Inspector General. He didn't know, he was on constantly on edge with everything he did. He didn't know which of his men was from the Inspector General's department.
Go on.
No, that's it horrified me. But I'd heard about this, and he said, I got to be very close friends with him. He was a first-class fellow.
Yeah.
Most of the battalion was made up of his construction company, I think.
Yeah,
Anyhow.
Good Lord.
That was a real eye-opener.
Yeah. So then, after that, you... comes a time when you decide to retire, and...
Yes, I the reason I stayed in after the war was over was I really honestly believed that we hadn't finished with the problems.
Yeah.
And
when
we had, I enjoyed the Army very much. I think very highly of Army life.
Mm-hmm.
I never met a really unhappy soldier, which... mean something when you're talking about political philosophies.
Yeah.
People like to be...
Well, I know, and again, I've never served with the American Army, but it always shocks me in many of the American films. Now, granted, these are films, but you hear such things as, you know, about fragging the officers, you frequently see in their wartime films what appears to be a constant bitter resentment between the officers and the other ranks and so on like that. I, as a former other rank and as a former officer, personally, I've never come across that in the Canadian Army.
There's no place you can be where there's more people to look after you, your own good, you know.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that a democratic army is a contradiction in terms. I think the Americans try to run a democratic army.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
I just wondered, did you come across any of that sort of thing with the Americans up there? You know, their, what would you call it nowadays, their personnel or personal relationship. Did it strike you as odd, some of the things their officers would do that we would never do or what have you?
Well, I don't suppose so. The Yukon was a very special place, very special.
Yeah. But it would throw you together, presumably.
Yes, yes.
So you could see it if...
No, I think I think we got along very well, and I think they behaved themselves very well. Had no troubles at all.
Yeah.
Except understanding each other. Once we understood.
Yeah.
The different.
Things. Procedures and,
yes,
and this, that, and the other, yeah. What sort of food did you have, their food or our food?
I'm sure we had our food. Food was good.
Yeah.
Maybe we had some of their... No, I'm sure we didn't have their food. Can't believe we did.
Yeah. I've always understood they ate pretty high off the hog, as the saying goes.
Yes.
The Americans.
Yeah.
Well, it's been quite an interesting career you've had. You've certainly bounced about more than most officers.
Yes, I had a lot of interesting things to do, and
it seems a shame in a way that you never got a chance to do a bit more at Whitby to instruct the people there in blowing things up and whatnot.
Yes, that would have been. However, you just took what came, you know. It was interesting to go through it, though, to go through the bit in England, the training, and all the interviews and everything, and the people you met.
Yeah.
The chap who was at Whitby, who was the chief instructor there, R.M. Brooker, I still see him. He's still living in the north of England. See him whenever I go over.
Ah, for heaven's sakes. Well, where do you live now? Is it down in Florida or back in Ontario? Or
I live in Kingston, Ontario.
In Kingston?
Yes.
But you know a fellow called Chubb?
Oh, Jerry Chubb?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Because when I was writing my book on Normandy, I was in correspondence with him quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And who else was down there? Do you have much to do with RMC?
Not too much. I belong to the mess at Fort Frontenac, which is the National Defense College.
Yeah.
But I go over to RMC periodically. I know some of the people there.
Do you know any of the historians there? Do you know Don Sherman, for example? Or?
No. But there is one fellow who used to be a historian there that I knew quite well.
An older man?
Yes.
What is his name? Just a minute. Preston? Dick Preston?
Yes.
You knew him,
yes.
Eh?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's an old friend of mine, too. Yeah.
I know the librarians better because...
the chap who died?
Yes.
Just a minute. I know the one you mean because I met him... Oh, damn it, I can see him so well, and his name just doesn't come to me. He died a couple of years ago.
That's right.
Single chap.
It should come to me. I made a collection of military figures, Dresden figures, or soldiers, you know, about this high.
Did you?
And they were very hard to get because they were commissioned, apparently, by Queen Victoria for issue to officers' messes. And I suppose they all got broken on mess nights. I don't know.
For heaven's sake.
But I managed to collect quite a large number of the ones that were made. And they were sculpted by Carl Thiem, who was a very well-known potter or designer in near Dresden, not the other place. Anyhow, these went to RMC. They're in the library now, in a case in the front hall.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Which is where they ought to be.
Yeah, oh gosh, that fellow's name just slipped in and slipped out.
Yes.
Oh, damn it. He was there for years.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, damn it. Well, it'll come to me. It'll come to me. Well, so you're resident in Kingston now, and that's where you're going to stay, or...?
I'd like to find an excuse to come out here, but I have three sons in the East and their families, so I don't know why they don't come out here.
Are they all engineers or different?
No, two of them are. One of them works for the government. He's a director of transportation fuels for the government.
Oh, yeah.
In his spare time, he owns an airport.
Oh, I see.
And his twin brother is a professor at Queen's. He's been there for 17 years now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mentioned this to the president here when I was talking to him the other day, and he reacted immediately that Queen's was pinching professors from here and paying them a lot more than he could. And I mentioned this yesterday to my son in Kingston on the phone, and he said, well, we're losing them to the United States.
Is
it's
that
a
right?
Part of a circle.
Is that right?
Yeah. But he admitted that BC was the very bottom of the ladder as far as university finances went.
Right now it is, yeah.
Yeah.
It used to be a way up.
It should be.
But they get waves like that. Yeah, quite true.
We've got to pay our teachers. If we don't, the whole country's going to fall apart.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, thank you kindly, sir, for coming in and your double interview and all that sort of thing. That's, there's little bits and pieces there, quite frankly, I hadn't heard of and I didn't know about. It's too bad some of the things that you were preparing for, in a way, didn't happen. I don't suggest we should have had an invasion of Japan, but if we did, it'd be interesting to see how your scheme would have worked.
Yes, I did pick up at one point one of those paper balloons the Chinese sent over.
I
don't know if you've ever seen that.
I've seen a picture of one.
I still have a chunk of the paper. It's the most incredible stuff that they made, even in those days.
Yeah.
It was completely indestructible, even in the water and everything, you know.
Good.
Tough paper.
Yeah.
They dropped them with incendiaries into the forests.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It could have been very, very
serious. They were thinking, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right you are. I better turn the old machine off and... That's